This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قُلْ إِن تُخْفُوا مَا فِي صُدُورِكُمْ أَوْ تُبْدُوهُ يَعْلَمْهُ اللَّهُ وَيَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says the U.S. president's allegations that the country is destabilizing West Asia is nothing but a failed rhetoric. The Qatari emir says Israel is increasing instability in the Middle East by expanding settlements, blockading Gaza, and changing the demography of Al-Quds. And a new wave of COVID is sweeping across South Korea with daily cases doubling to 40,000. Our report from Seoul, just ahead. Thank you for joining us. Iran says the United States is trying to foment tension and crisis in West Asia by resorting to the failed policy of Iranophobia. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani made the remarks in reaction to U.S. President Joe Biden, who accused Iran of destabilizing activities in West Asia. Kanani also slammed Biden for raising false accusations regarding Tehran's peaceful nuclear energy program, while ignoring decades of deception by the Israeli regime as the largest possessor of nuclear weapons in the region. During an address to the GCC Plus 3 summit in Jeddah, Biden said the U.S. will remain as an active player in the region and will not walk away to leave a vacuum to be filled by China, Russia, or Iran. U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to West Asia has seen new rhetoric against Iran by Washington and its ally, Israel. The two sides have signed a declaration that pledges more military support for Israel and claims to counter what they call Iran's threats. Tehran has denounced the declaration and rhetoric by the U.S. president threatening to use force against the Islamic Republic.
U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid have reiterated their anti-Iran positions in a joint declaration. The two leaders signed this statement after holding a one-on-one meeting on Thursday morning in occupied territories, on the second day of Biden's four-day tour of West Asia. The statement says that the U.S. will use all elements of national power available to it to deny Iran the ability to arm itself with nuclear weapons. The joint declaration also includes a pledge by Washington to continue U.S. military aid to Israel. Hours after the announcement of the declaration, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi warned of harsh and regrettable responses, saying any interventions of foreign powers in the region only results in crises and destabilization, while describing Iran's military power as a security factor. Observers believe that the unconditional support of the U.S. for Israel as the only regime that openly threatens Iran with military aggression can further embolden Tel Aviv.
I don't think that Biden's visit to the Middle East has really anything to do with arms sales. I think that essentially he's come first and foremost to try to get the Saudis to push up oil production to try to bring down prices at the gas pumps in the United States as Biden moves toward November 5th. Midterm elections for Congress and the Senate, where right now he's expected not to do too well. What I think this stems from is Israel's push to try to get the United States thinking somehow that they're going to intimidate Iran, which is ludicrous. That's not going to happen.
Iran topped the agenda of talks between the U.S. president and Israeli officials during the latest regional tour by Biden. They discussed Iran's nuclear energy program and its military might, which they labeled as a threat to the region. That comes as the U.S. has been pushing for the formation of a NATO-style military alliance against Iran in the region.
U.S. President's visit to the region comes as Washington and Israel have been pushing for an alliance of regional countries against Iran, the so-called Arab NATO. At the heart of such military alliance lies the perceived threat from Iran. Iranian officials have repeatedly denounced the destabilizing activities of Israel as the main source of insecurity in the region, warning regional countries of the perils of allowing the regime to establish a foothold in the region. Regional states and nations will not achieve stability and peace as long as the fake Israeli regime remains the first stop of U.S. President's trips, with the main target being to preserve the regime's security and dominance. The Islamic Republic of Iran considers the security of its neighbors as its own security. Despite the growing relations between Israel and the Persian Gulf countries amid gradual American withdrawal from the region, several observers consider the emergence of a genuine NATO-style alliance unlikely.
You understand how much more powerful Iran has become in the region precisely because of its alliance with China and Russia. And so if you look at the offshoot of this, is that any threat to Iran also becomes a threat to Russia. Now, Israel, people in Tel Aviv, they understand this. They understand that there's been a shift in the balance of power in the region, and this frightens them. The reaction has been the attempt to build some sort of Middle East NATO. And that's not going to fly. It's not going to fly any more than the talk of European unity. That doesn't exist vis-a-vis Russia. It's just a contrived narrative.
A number of controversial questions are being posed by those analyzing Biden's visit and the so-called Arab NATO. The first question is whether the Arab states need such an alliance. Is the existing joint Arab defense framework so useless that it must be replaced by this new regional NATO? Second, the pact expects to be formed against Iran, but there are differing views on Iran's policies in the region. To include Israel, an occupier of Arab lands, in a new framework against Iran would only exacerbate the regional crises. In fact, a number of Arab officials have openly said in the past few days that their countries would not be a part of an alliance against Iran. And last but not least, not every country has normalized relations with Israel to form a common pact.
Israeli police say an officer has been killed after being run over by a Palestinian at a checkpoint in the occupied territories. The incident happened near the city of Ra'anana. Police have identified a Palestinian as a 17-year-old from the occupied West Bank area of Ramallah. They say he has been arrested. No further details are currently available on the incident. Tensions have been running high in the occupied territories recently as the Israeli military cracks down on Palestinians. More than 60 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces this year, many of them in raids. At least 19 people have also been killed in Israel in attacks by Palestinian individuals since March. Now let me bring in Mona Candil, our correspondent in Ramallah, for more details. Mona, please tell us more.
Well, it's the Israeli military statement claiming that a 17-year-old Palestinian, originally from an area near Ramallah, this Palestinian teen was chased by Israeli police because they are claiming that he hit an Israeli police officer and killed him when he was driving a vehicle, a stolen vehicle. This is according to the Israeli police narration. Following this incident, Israeli troops chased this Palestinian teen who left his vehicle and he was running, of course, on his feet. And then at the end of the day, they arrested him. It's not clear up till the moment what are the motives or the real story, what happened. If it's true that this Palestinian intended to run over Israeli police officers and kill one of them, or because he was driving a stolen vehicle, and when he saw the Israeli police chasing him, then he was trying to escape. But up to the moment, we can say, according to the Israelis, that a 17-year-old Palestinian teen was arrested after he ran over Israeli police officer and killed him in the area of Ra'anana, near Tel Aviv Central, Israel, the land occupied in 1948.
Mona, thank you so much. Have a nice day. That was Mona Candil, our correspondent in Ramallah. Moving on, the Emir of Qatar slams Israel as a major source of tension in the Middle East. Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani says instability will persist in the region unless the regime stops its violations of international law. The Qatari Emir noted Israeli settlement constructions, the regime's attempts to change the demography of Al-Quds, and its blockade of the Gaza Strip are the root cause of instability and tension. He called for the need to find a just solution to the Palestine issue, adding the matter is a central cause for the Arab and Muslim people. Sheikh Tamim made the remarks during the GCC Plus 3 summit in Jeddah. The COVID-19 Omicron variant BA5 is surging in South Korea, with new daily cases doubling to 40,000 per day this week. The surge comes as another Omicron variant has been detected in the country, with growing concern about public apathy. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
Yet another wave of COVID-19 is hitting South Korea, with cases doubling to 40,000 per day in the past week. The BA5 Omicron subvariant accounts for almost a third of the new cases, a portion that is increasing. While experts recognize vaccines may not always prevent infection, they decrease illnesses and deaths.
Even people who have been infected with Omicron before are not able to develop enough immunity to this variant unless they are vaccinated. People who have been fully vaccinated and boosted but become infected have reduced chances of severe illness of 70 to 90%.
The fatality rate of COVID-19 has dropped to near the seasonal flu. Still, experts argue that changed behaviors of mask wearing and routine vaccinations should remain in place.
The recent spike in COVID-19 cases here comes as South Korea Thursday detects the first case of BA2.75, nicknamed Centaurus. Scientists worry this highly mutated Omicron variant is even more transmissible than previous strains.
Some want stronger antivirus enforcement, suggesting public apathy risks another COVID-induced economic downturn.
I know that more than 90% of corona can be prevented by wearing a mask, but if people keep coming inside and taking off their masks, I feel like it will be impossible to stop the spread. So the government should take stronger measures in that area.
People are required to wear masks on transit, but the government has said it will not implement lockdowns. People over 50 will be offered fourth vaccinations next week. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The International Committee of the Red Cross says Yemeni women and children are dying on a daily basis due to poor health care services in the war-torn country. Abdul Latif Al-Washili reports from Sana'a.
Despite the UN-brokered truce, the consequences of the Saudi lid war are still taking the lives of Yemeni women and children. A recent report by the International Committee of the Red Cross says a mother and six newborns die every 2 hours in Yemen of complications that occur during pregnancy and causes that can be avoided in normal circumstances.
There is a severe shortage of medical supplies and medicines, as well as a significant increase in the prices of medicines, which has led to the deterioration of health services not only in the countryside, but even in main cities.
We as gynecologists have noticed a significant increase in the number of abortions, especially premature abortions in the early stages of pregnancy. Therefore, we hope to conduct studies that will reveal to us the reason and whether or not the prohibited weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition contributed to this tragedy.
The committee says the numbers are likely to increase due to a lack of health services or poor care provided, especially amid a shortage of funding for the United Nations programs in Yemen, as well as the termination of aid related to reproductive health and mother and child health.
The deteriorating economic situation has increased malnutrition among mothers, which has had a negative impact on newborns. The blockade of Yemen, which has kept medicines and medical supplies from entering the country, has resulted in an increase in death recently, and there are indications that the abortion rate has increased.
Recently, most of the United Nations programs, including the World Food Program, announced the suspension of their humanitarian activities in Yemen due to a lack of funding, as well as the consequences of the Russia-Ukraine war.
Yemeni health officials say 19 million Yemenis lack access to health care. They say it is a shame for the international community to abandon Yemeni women and the children who have been paying the highest price since the beginning of the Saudi-led war in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A sizable number of lawmakers blame the West's aggressive foreign policy towards Moscow for the cost of living crisis currently impacting EU citizens. The 27-nation bloc is facing an energy crisis after cutting off oil imports from Russia over the conflict in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that 22% of people in the EU are struggling to make ends meet. That's almost 100 million citizens who are counting every cent. Apparently, sending weapons to Ukraine is not the answer.
The best way to deal with the cost of living crisis is to stop prolonging the war. The people of Europe favour peace, even well above punishing Russia.
EU financial markets are in turmoil. There are calls for the introduction of a windfall tax.
Energy prices and food prices are going through the roof. Capitalists make profits by speculating on markets and thereby hurting millions of households.
Members of the public have been talking to us about the current state of the EU's economy.
It's terrifying to see that our free market is like collapsing. All the money that we are going to send to Ukraine, then we will have to need this money, and where we are going to take this money from.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has been singled out for criticism in the European Parliament.
We turn now about the increase of cost of living in the European Union, which is just a result of the insane and unsound policies promoted by the European Union since Ursula von der Leyen took office.
There have been calls for greater solidarity between EU member states to deal with the cost of living crisis.
In order to make sure that we are not at the end dividing Europe in those who are able to help and those who have more difficulties.
On sanctions against Russia, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has said, quote, "Initially I thought that we had only shot ourselves in the foot, but now it is clear that the EU economy has shot itself in the lungs and is gasping for air." Many here agree. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
زیارت قدیر. In the name of God, the Merciful, the Compassionate. Salam, dear listeners. Here is the third and penultimate part of the memorable Ziyarat of Qadir, or standard form of salutation to the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, the first and second parts of which we presented to you yesterday and the day before. Please stay with us. Our Lord, we believe in what you have sent down, and we follow the prophet. So write us among the witnesses. Our Lord, do not make our hearts swerve after you have guided us, and bestow your mercy on us. Indeed, you are the All-Munificent. O Allah, we know that this is the truth from you. So let your curse be on those who oppose it, deny it, and gainsay it out of arrogance. And the wrongdoers will soon know at what goal they will end up. Peace to you, O Commander of the Faithful, Chief of the Legatees, the foremost of the devout, and the most self-denying of the ascetics. And may Allah's mercy and His bounties, blessings and greetings be to you. You are the one who gave food for the love of Him to the needy, the orphan, and the prisoner, saying, "We feed you only for the sake of Allah. We do not want any reward from you, nor any thanks." And it was concerning you that Allah revealed, "They prefer others to themselves, though poverty be their own lot. And those who are saved from their own greed, it is they who are the felicitous." You were the one who suppressed your anger and excused the faults of the people, and Allah loves the virtuous. You are the one who were patient in stress and distress, and in the heat of battle. You distributed the public funds equitably and carried out justice amongst the subjects. You knew Allah's laws better than the entire creation, and Allah the Most High has informed us concerning the grace that He bestowed upon you when He said, "Is someone who is faithful like someone who is a transgressor? They are not equal. As for those who have faith and do righteous deeds, for them are gardens of the abode, a hospitality for what they used to do." You are the one endowed with the knowledge of the Quranic revelation, the rules of interpretation, the prophet's designation, and to you belong the prominent and noteworthy occasions and illustrious stations, the historic days such as the day of the Battle of Badr and the day of the Confederates. As God says, "When the eyes rolled with fear and the hearts leaped to the throats, and you entertained misgivings about Allah, it was there that the faithful were tested and jolted with a severe agitation. And when the hypocrites were saying, as well as those in whose hearts is a sickness, 'Allah and His Prophet did not promise us except delusion.' And when a group of them said, 'O people of Yathrib, this is not a place for you, so go back,' and a group of them sought the Prophet's permission, saying, 'Our homes lie exposed to the enemy,' although they were not exposed, they only sought to flee. And Allah the Most High has said, 'But when the faithful saw the Confederates, they said, "This is what Allah and His Prophet had promised us." And Allah and His Prophet were true, and it only increased them in faith and submission." Then you slew their Amr and routed their hosts, and Allah sent back the faithless in their rage without their attaining any advantage. And Allah spared the faithful of fighting, and Allah is all strong, almighty. And on the day of the Battle of Uhud, when they were fleeing without paying any attention to anyone, while the Prophet was calling them from their rear, and you were chasing away the multitudes of the idolaters, from the Prophet to the right and to the left until Allah made them withdraw from the two of you in fear, and through you gave victory to the defeated Muslim troops. And on the day of the Battle of Hunain, as declared in the Revelation, when your great number impressed you, but it did not avail you in any way, and the earth became narrow for you in spite of its expanse, whereupon you turned your backs to flee. Then Allah sent down His composure upon His Prophet and upon the faithful. The faithful were you and your comrades, and Abbas, your uncle, who was shouting out to the fleeing Muslim warriors, O disciples of the Surat al-Baqarah, O performers of the allegiance of the tree. Whereupon they responded to him, after you had spared them the hardships of warfare and took upon yourself the defense of Islam without them. Thereat they returned, having lost hope of the divine reward, and yet hopeful of the fulfillment of the promise of Allah through repentance, and that is referred to in the words of Allah, glorified be His name. Then Allah shall turn clemently that to whomever He wishes. While you enjoyed the high station of fortitude and attained a great reward. And again, on the day of Khaybar, when Allah divulged the weakness of the hypocrites and decimated the infidels, and all praise belongs to Allah, the Lord of all the worlds, though they had certainly pledged to Allah before that they would not turn their backs, and pledges given to Allah are accountable. My Master, you are Allah's conclusive testament, the clear path, the bountiful blessing, and the shining proof. Hence, congratulations to you for the grace bestowed on you by Allah, and woe to your ignorant enemies. You participated with the Prophet, may Allah bless him and his household, in all his battles and campaigns, carrying the banner before him and fighting at his fore with the sword. On account of your well-known judiciousness and your insight in all matters, the Prophet made you commander on many occasions, and never was anyone appointed commander over you. Many were the cases when your God-wariness withheld you from carrying out your resolve, whereas others followed their desires in similar cases, leading the ignorant to imagine that you lacked the ability to carry it out. By God, those who imagined such a thing went astray and were not rightly guided. You have certainly clarified the misconceptions of those who have entertained them and disputed your abilities. With your statement, may Allah's blessings be upon you. The experienced and the ingenious person cites the course of artifice, and short of it, sees the barrier posed by the God-fearing, whereat he disregards it right away at the first sight. But those who have no scruples in religion seize the opportunity provided by it. By God, you have stated the truth, and those who pursued false ideas were losers. When the two who broke their oath of allegiance tried to deceive you, saying that they intended to perform Umrah pilgrimage, you told them, by your lives, your intention is not to perform Umrah, but to carry out treason. Then you took their oath of allegiance and made them renew their pledge, but they rallied to sedition. Thus, when you apprised them of their conduct, they disregarded it and went back without drawing any benefit, and the outcome of their conduct was ruin. Then they were followed by the Syrians, led by the rebel Muawiyah ibn Abu Sufyan, and you marched towards them for the war of Siffin, after having vindicated your stand, whereas they neither followed the true religion nor reflected upon the Quran. They were the misguided rebel who disbelieved what had been revealed to Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and supported the antagonists against you, whereas Allah, the Most High, had commanded them to follow you and urged the faithful to support you when He, the Almighty and Glorious, declared, O you who have faith, be wary of Allah and be with the truthful. Dear friends, that was the third and penultimate part of the famous ziyarah of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, for the blessed day of Ghadir. Tune in again tomorrow to listen to the fourth and concluding part. God bless you.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Saudi ties with the United States. Part 1.
Well, the long classified pages detailing alleged ties of the Saudi Arabian government to the 9/11 hijackers have now been released by Congress.
They confirm what many have suspected all along, that the 9/11 hijackers...
15 years after the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. government finally released the long-classified parts of an official report on an inquiry into its intelligence community activities before and after the attacks. Those parts were 28 out of hundreds of pages that provided details about the incident and results of the inquiry. According to these 28 pages, a number of officials of the Saudi embassy in Washington and its affiliated institutes had close ties with people involved in hijacking commercial planes and crashing them into the World Trade Center in New York City. The officials had helped the hijackers travel, reside, study, and even receive driving education in the U.S. 15 out of 19 people who carried out the 9/11 attacks were Saudi citizens. But for everyone, especially the families of the victims, it was very strange that what made different American administrations, from Democrat to Republican, act so cautiously in this regard. Years on, those families, as well as journalists and observers, are still confused about such stance. It seems strange for everyone that where this bond began and how it grew that has granted such immunity to Saudi Arabia, whose relationship still continues with the U.S. despite the fact that thousands of Americans were killed in the 9/11 attacks. The Saudi story begins in this city.
Today, Riyadh is a modern city with very beautiful buildings as well as wide and long highways. Images of the king and the young crown prince can be seen everywhere. A crown prince who's an exception in the 100-year history of the Saudi royal family. No one has so far got the chance to acquire this position at this age. Of course, everything was different in the days when Al Saud decided to conquer this city to expand its rule all over the region that today is known as Saudi Arabia. In those days, different tribes were living in Najd and Hejaz regions, which were fighting for their survival, and Al Saud was one of those tribes. Abdulaziz bin Abdulrahman bin Saud was the one who decided to wage a war in the early years of the 20th century. To fulfill his dreams, he needed a sword that could defeat all tribes, and at that time, this sword belonged to the Brotherhood. The Brotherhood was the name of a group of people who were staunch followers of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. They were very warlike and merciless, and that was exactly what Al Saud needed. The bond between Al Saud and Abdul Wahhab, which existed for more than 100 years, had become stronger and helped Abdulaziz conquer Riyadh in 1902. The conflict continued until a few years after the end of the First World War. And Abdulaziz declared his rule on the entire Saudi Arabia in 1926 after defeating Hejaz ruler Sharif Hussein. Al Saud felt indebted to the Brotherhood, whose position was increasingly improving in this family. In 1932, Abdulaziz bin Saud put the name of his clan on a country that today we know as Saudi Arabia and officially declared its existence. Several years after Abdulaziz took power in Saudi Arabia, the number of pilgrims of Hajj, which was one of the main sources of income for the Saudi ruler, began to decrease due to a global financial crisis that erupted in the U.S. In 1929, the number of Hajj pilgrims was about 130,000, which was reduced to 40,000 two years later. The financial situation of Abdulaziz was so bad in those days that he told one of his American friends, Philby, that he would give any concessions to anyone giving him a million lira. Al Saud had come to power with the help of the merciless Brotherhood and apparently needed them to survive. But the Saudi royal family had to find a new way to pay the country's expenses, and at that time, oil was the best solution. In the early 1930s, many countries were trying to sign contracts with the Al Saud that was already in possession of vast oil resources. During that time, there was stiff competition between British and American companies for taking oil exploration patents.
Finally, on May the 29th, 1933, and after weeks of negotiations with Saudi officials, representatives of the American company Standard Oil of California signed the contract with the Saudi king for the oil exploration in Saudi Arabia. American experts began exploring oil in the heat of scorching deserts of Saudi Arabia, and in 1938, and after 5 years of exploring, they gained their first achievement in Dammam area, a few kilometers north of the city of Dhahran, and at the seventh drilling site. But the beginning of the story of the U.S. and Al Saud family dates back to the final days of the Second World War. That's when then-U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt was returning from the Yalta Conference on the Crimean Peninsula. There, he, along with British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and Soviet Premier Joseph Stalin, had shared the spoils of war, especially in Europe, several days before. When USS Quincy, the ship carrying Roosevelt, reached the Suez Canal, it made a short stop at Bitter Lake so that he could meet with a number of Arab and African leaders, the most important of whom was Abdulaziz bin Saud, the king of the newly established country of Saudi Arabia. A warship had gone to Jeddah to bring Abdulaziz to the Suez Canal. Abdulaziz had told everyone that he was heading for Mecca, and until the last moment, nobody knew that the destination was the pier of Jeddah. Abdulaziz, leading a 48-member delegation of his aides, entered Quincy to officially meet with one of the world's leaders outside of Saudi Arabia. The meeting took place on February the 14th. The most important lines of discussions between Roosevelt and Ibn Saud on board this ship have to date determined the main structure of political ties between the U.S. and Al Saud. The U.S. demanded oil, and Al Saud was in need of security. Following the U.S. economic crisis in the 1930s, Roosevelt was making industrial and economic reforms for 13 years and knew that his country required vast oil resources, especially after the end of World War II, and Saudi Arabia was the country which could meet that requirement. In return, Abdulaziz demanded the U.S. improve his country's security and provide it with the technology needed to make changes on the condition that the U.S. does not interfere in Saudi Arabia's internal affairs, especially religious issues. Saudi Arabia's religious structure, which was based on Wahhabi ideology, was very impervious and fiercely resisted any change or signs from a foreign culture. Sometime after the meeting between Abdulaziz and Roosevelt, during which the alliance between the two countries became stronger, a flow of American advisors in different fields headed to Saudi Arabia to prepare the grounds for the presence of thousands of Americans and their families in the future. Even the presence of these experts was not to the liking of strict Wahhabi leaders, who strongly expressed their displeasure and informed the king of it. The Wahhabi leaders knew that the presence of those advisors would result in changes that are inconsistent with their ideology. Abdulaziz, who had no other way but to invite the American advisors, tried to convince the religious leaders. He cited Prophet Muhammad's cooperation with Christians as an indication legitimizing the presence of the American advisors in Saudi Arabia. With the discovery of new oil fields and extracting more oil, the image of Saudi Arabia began to change, and Saudi rulers, who once lived in deserts, moved to their new palaces. The most important economic income of Saudi Arabia was now from two key sources. One was the annual Hajj pilgrimage that each year attracted millions of Muslims from across the world, and the other one was a precious treasure called oil that lied beneath the sands of this land and made Saudi Arabia one of the richest countries in the world. The middle years of the 20th century marked a period when communist thinking was growing across the world, and at the same time, Arab countries were witnessing a rise in nationalism and pan-Arabism. Both were not to the liking of Saudi authorities and influential clerics, and therefore could not be welcomed in Saudi Arabia. After Gamal Abdel Nasser Hussein came to power in Egypt, and following challenges between him and Muslim Brotherhood supporters, Saudi Arabia opened its doors to the elite of this group so that they can live and work there. Any specialist, from medics to engineers and teachers, was allowed to go to Saudi Arabia. The bulk of those migrants were teachers and university lecturers who left a significant impact on future generations in Saudi Arabia. Based on extreme Wahhabi views, Muslim Brotherhood supporters were also considered strangers, but at least they were Muslims and better than Western infidels. The immigration of Muslim Brotherhood supporters from Egypt, Syria, and Jordan to Saudi Arabia during the 1960s and 70s left a significant impact on the Saudi society in the years that followed. One of those people was Abdullah Yusuf Azam, a scholar who years later played a key role in the formation of militant groups in Islamic countries. In 1973, Arabs and Israel fought a war known as October War. Arab countries were seeking to make up for the defeat they suffered during a six-day war with Israel several years before. Egypt from the south and Syria from the north launched a lightning attack on Israel. Arab countries made gains in the early days of war. That prompted the U.S. to intervene in support of Israel. The
largest logistical line was set up to supply Israel with new weapons and change the balance of war, and that assistance turned to be working. In response, Arab countries halted oil exports in support of Egypt and Syria, and as a result, an unprecedented shock pushed oil prices up. The oil prices that did not increase by even a cent in the 1960s suddenly jumped from $3 to $12 a barrel. That was a record price in the market. The economic pressure caused by oil sanctions was so severe that the U.S. was even mulling over military action against Saudi Arabia. But the plan was never implemented after oil sanctions were lifted in March of 1974. Even after the war ended, the world was still grappling with the impacts of the shock caused by high oil prices, but oil exporting countries gained wealth they had never seen before, and Saudi Arabia naturally was at the top of these countries. The pumping of so much money into Saudi Arabia changed its social image in the years that followed. The most important feature of that change was a tendency to modern Western lifestyle, something which many Wahhabi religious centers in Saudi Arabia were unhappy with. A society which had reacted angrily to the advent of television 10 years before in 1965 was now facing a storm of change. Cities were expanding and new buildings were being constructed one after another. During these years, many families were making a huge profit from construction across Saudi Arabia, and the Bin Laden family was one of them. The Bin Ladens had come close with the royal family, which helped it sign many contracts to carry out development projects, including the one to develop and renovate Masjid al-Haram, or the Sacred Mosque.
In the limelight.
Making a mockery of his own campaign vow to treat the repressive Saudi kingdom as a pariah, U.S. President Joe Biden recently greeted Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who intelligence agencies believe approved the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, with a fist bump as he arrived at the Royal Palace in Jeddah. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading From Bonesaw to Pariah to Fist Bump, Outrage as Biden Greets Madras Saudi Prince. Stay tuned for more. Making a mockery of his own campaign vow to treat the repressive Saudi kingdom as a pariah, U.S. President Joe Biden recently greeted Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who intelligence agencies believe approved the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, with a fist bump as he arrived at the Royal Palace in Jeddah. Already furious over the president's decision to meet with the crown prince, despite his role in the brutal 2018 murder of Khashoggi and subsequent cover-up attempt, human rights defenders responded with outrage to the greeting, which the Saudi regime swiftly blasted out on social media. The bloody fist bump scene around the world, said Sarah Lee Whitson, executive director of Democracy for the Arab World Now, adding, "You have humiliated our entire country." Hatice Cengiz, the fiancé of Khashoggi, a U.S. resident who wrote for the Washington Post before he was tortured, killed, and dismembered with a bone saw inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, replied on Twitter, "The meeting between Biden and the Saudi Crown Prince, commonly known as MBS, is expected to touch on a range of issues, from the U.S.-backed Saudi war on Yemen to oil production in the midst of ongoing conflicts in Eastern Europe." Biden, on Thursday, refused to commit to bringing up Khashoggi's murder during the meeting. In an interview ahead of Biden's visit, she told the Associated Press that Biden is backing down on human rights in the interest of boosting oil production. Just under 3 years ago, during his 2020 presidential campaign, Biden promised to make the Saudi leadership pay the price for the Khashoggi murder and make them, in fact, the pariah that they are. She said, "It's a very huge backing down, actually. It's heartbreaking and disappointing. And Biden will lose his moral authority by putting oil and expediency over principles and values."